welcome in Wrong Side of the Pond. I am Jeremy Lance, DJ Schweitzer, at his house, I'm assuming, enjoying the holiday break that he and his family are on. I'm sure you're doing that as well. We said we weren't going to do a podcast this week, obviously, like most podcasts, radio shows, whatever you listen to and enjoy. This is generally a dead period where they take some time off. We are still technically doing that. DJ and I did not get together and put together a podcast, but we are putting together something for you, which is a look back, a collection of the interviews and people that we talked to in 2016. So if you know our schedule of how we do podcasts, obviously that means interviews that we did in the back half of season 3 and then the ones that we've done now here so far in season 4. We'll be back next week. Obviously, a lot to talk about. Bob Bradley's been canned. Darlington Nagby won't be going to Celtic now. Obviously, that speaks to a larger discussion about how, with a single-entity league that MLS is, how you have a league making these decisions on the global market. It's not just club versus club and club talking to each other. And, oh yeah, there's been like a million matches. So we will get to all of that next week. So settle in. We got some good interviews here. We are going to start with Peter Wilt. We had him on back in the springtime before. I believe it was right before the NASL, USL, really the U.S. soccer calendar started up. We had him on to talk about, obviously, the fact that he is trying to start a team in Chicago for NASL. And why NASL? Why Chicago? And yeah, here it is.
With the fire in town, obviously, and you helped build that up, and this new group that you're bringing in, what do you guys see are going to be your maybe philosophical differences of how you're going to run things?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I haven't really gotten that one before. I mean, I do think that when you have two teams in a market, it's important to have points of differentiation. And one of the examples in Major League Soccer was Los Angeles, where you had Chivas USA come in after the Galaxy had been around for a number of years. And I think one of many challenges that Chivas USA had is they had no geographic point of differentiation. They literally played in the exact same spot as the LA Galaxy, so they were no easier or more difficult to get to support than maybe their biggest competition. From a philosophical standpoint, all I can say is, we're going to do what I think my teams have always done, and that's establish a broad base of support, give the fans a real sense of ownership, and in this case, what we're expecting to do is give fans real ownership in the team and give them some transparency, openness, and an ability to direct. I think we have differentiations just by geography, and if we can, the Chicago NASL team can serve the city better and make the fans here feel like this is their team, we'll have a good chance of success. And, that's what fan support is about, is emotional connections where the fans believe the athletes playing on the field are playing for them. It's that mentality that gets fans passionate about a team. And that comes from one-on-one connections with players, with staff, and with the opportunity for those fans to feel like they have control and a say in the team.
This is not your first rodeo in Chicago, obviously. What from all the endeavors that you've had in a soccer front there in Chicago, what are some of the things that you've learned, like, okay, we're going to maybe do this differently this time, or this, we've got to make sure we do this just like they did this?
Yeah, it's evolved, I think, over time. And Chicago is a very educated market. It's a diverse market. But it still is the three general audiences American cities have, and that's the new Americans, the ethnics, and there's the millennials, 18 to 34-year-olds, especially urban young adults, and then also suburban soccer fans. In Chicago, maybe there's a longer history of support, and again, more educated. You can't, certainly can't fool them. When you make a mistake, you need to admit it and say you're going to try to do better next time. But I think they respect it when you're open and transparent with them.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I think we saw out of at least Indy 11, you know, and that's the most evident example that we can go with right now is you provided a transparency at that club that I feel like a lot of other soccer clubs maybe don't provide to their fan bases. And to me, that seemed like a big reason why you guys found such immediate success in the support realm there. And I don't know if you can elaborate a little bit on that thought and why you think Indianapolis ended up having the splash with Indy 11.
Yeah, I think there's a sense of authenticity and a real representation of Central Indiana that Hoosiers really appreciate. I mean, they're very proud of their community, and they'll support things that are local. A difference between Chicago and Indiana, I think, is that I mentioned earlier the well-educated soccer fan in Chicago. There are many of those in Indianapolis, but I think the general sports fan that did latch on to Indy 11 is not a real educated soccer fan. And I think certainly early on, they didn't know any difference between Major League Soccer and the North American Soccer League, and they probably didn't care. In Chicago, it's not going to be like that. In Chicago, the fans do know the difference between MLS and NASL, First Division. And
oh, no.
Challenging. We're going to have to prove the quality of our fan experience on the field and off the field to justify Chicagoans not only spending their money, but spending their time coming to Chicago NASL games.
You mentioned the whole MLS-NASL difference thing, and I want to hit on that point. This is your second, hopefully successful endeavor into NASL, and is there something about that league that you prefer more than MLS or something that you feel that they can provide? What's been your drawn towards NASL?
Right now, they gave me an opportunity. I guess
that helps. That helps.
Take them where you can.
I got tired of holding my breath. I mean, there's pluses and minuses of both leagues. I mean, obviously the resources at MLS are...
No, boy.
Uh-oh.
More of an entrepreneurial league. It's a bit of a underdog, and it's fun. You know, you try to make the most of the least, but you have to act and walk the walk and talk the talk of a major league team. These owners have ambition. They have ambition to be first division teams, and that means putting more resources into it, on the field, off the field, hiring quality people, going about things in a professional manner. Because with the designation of Division II, people are going to want to categorize us as minor league, even though we're not. So there is a need to excel and exceed expectations. And that's why, in our case, it's so important that we play in one of the major venues in Chicago. If we just go to a high school venue and spruce it up, it'll just be doubling down on this image that the NASL had, that it's a lower division league. And in Chicago, that's not good enough. We need to give fans a first division experience. That's going to take resources. It's going to take quality efforts, quality branding, and all of that.
Well, obviously, that was back in February, I believe, and as we all know, the future of NASL still up in the air. I guess we're going to get a decision in January about what will happen with NASL. So, obviously, that changes things for Peter Wilt and what his Chicago NASL group will be able to do or not do. So, we hope for the best for him. Next, we got a chance to talk to a guy who ended up being a pretty big deal in the USL this season. This was back in April, I think, really just after the first match, first home match of the season for FC Cincinnati. We didn't, I guess, at the time know how big of a deal this guy would end up being. Obviously, now we know he had such a good season, won the Golden Boot, won the MVP, that he got himself a contract now with NYCFC. That is Sean Ugo Akoli. Got a chance to talk to him just about, you know, making the move here to Cincinnati and just what it's been like so far being in Cincinnati, playing that first match, scoring that first goal here for the home crowd.
So when you got, I don't know if it was your agent calling you or FC Cincinnati representatives, but when it came down to like, hey, this new USL club starting up, John Harkes is running it, you know, that they're interested, what kind of went through your mind?
You know, because I was talking with John and Tino, Ryan Martin, earlier or at the end of last year about, you know, possibly working with them in this upcoming year. And it was something I was very interested in. I know John's a legend of a U.S. soccer player, and I met him when I was at Wake, and I've obviously worked with Tino when I was at Wake as well. So, you know, something that that was very interesting to me. And luckily for both sides, things worked out to the point where, you know, we were able to get an agreement, and I was able to join the team for the year. So it's been great so far, and I'm really enjoying it.
So, talking about joining the team, Ugo, you were like one of the last guys to meet up. You like left wherever you were beforehand and came immediately to Florida to join the team and had to like leave everything behind. You've finally gotten settled. I know you and I talked a little bit about this the other day, but you've finally gotten settled in the city. How are you liking Cincinnati? You feel like it's a good fit for you so far?
Oh, yeah. I've been loving it so far. I didn't know what to expect when I first flew out here, but, you know, as time went on, I've been looking for places to shop, places to eat. The city looks real beautiful when I go downtown, and I've just been enjoying it. You know, having the teammates, like some of the guys on the team here, you know, exploring it, the city with them as well, makes things easier too. But I really enjoyed it. I'm hoping the weather clears up a little bit. Besides that, it's been great.
Yeah, that'll happen around here.
Yeah, you'll notice that every once in a while you'll feel like spring's here, and then you'll get a snow. Like
pulls
just to
back,
pull
you
back
nope,
in.
Just kidding.
Sorry about
that. Yeah, I actually saw that last week, and I don't know, I haven't seen that before, but it's just how it is out here in Cincy, huh?
So now we have to ask you, though, have you been initiated into being a Cincinnati guy? Have they made you try Cincinnati-style chili yet? Have you given that a go?
As of now, no. I think I'm still waiting for something, but nothing's happened yet.
I have to get that taken care of. DJ, I'm looking at you.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll you know, Skyline's a club sponsor. We should probably
feel like this.
I feel like we got to make this work.
Should have it easily.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into what happened over the weekend. The big home opener, finally getting to play a real match in front of the home crowd. I mean, just from your I watched on TV. DJ was there. I know a lot of people listening were in the stands. From your perspective, how just amazing was Saturday night?
I mean, it was surreal. When I was walking out on the field, words couldn't explain, you know, the feeling I was going through. It felt like, we were expecting about 11,000, which was crazy as is, you know. But walking out and you just look up at the crowd and it's loud and everybody's getting, you know, into the game. And then we have the Bailey behind the goal just going nuts. You know, it's just a surreal feeling. And it was a great experience and a great moment for me, you know. Being out there, being able to get a goal to help the team, you know, win their first ever home game at Nippert. So
you get
great feeling, man.
You get that goal. What was that, like 6 minutes in, 5 minutes in?
Yeah, fifth minute, I believe.
I mean, let's talk about this goal. We alluded to earlier this scissor kick goal. All of a sudden, it's gone viral. It's made SportsCenter top 10 plays. It's been retweeted like crazy. Like, how has that reaction been from your end, just seeing how once again, this is the second FC Cincinnati goal to go viral so far, and now it's your turn, and it's really blown up.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. To be honest, I didn't know many people would see it, but I don't know. I just think it's funny that I got that reaction. I was getting a lot of texts from my boys from home, and they're just giving me a lot of crap, you know. Like, you do that, or like, wow, like, Techers, you got some Techers now, this and that. And they also made fun of me a little bit, like, oh, yeah, you look real cute in orange, you know? it was funny, man. And like I said earlier, it's just a surreal moment for me. And, you know, I put a lot of work in to get to where I'm at. I'm glad to see some quality show up. And, you know, everyone gets to see what I'm doing now, you know? So it's been good.
Well, you'd mentioned Ibrahimovic, and he's a man known for acrobatic goals. So at bare minimum, you're living up to the standard you're setting for yourself.
I'm trying, man. I mean, no one does it like Zlatan, but yeah, I guess you could say that I watched one too many Zlatan videos.
It's all right. It's paying off. So, Sean, I've got just one last question for you before we let you go tonight. You know, one of the things that, you know, you and I have gotten to know each other fairly well over the last couple months, and one of the things that I know definitely well about you is that you've got some real strong shoe game. You got some kicks that are super fly.
Oh, boy. And, here we go. Sneakerheads.
Yeah, and I want to know what are the next shoes that we can see Ugo Ekwueli sporting around that everyone's going to be gasping at?
I don't know, man. I'm not trying to boast or anything, but I have a lot of options I could work with. But I really love my pair of Yeezy 350 Boost and Pirate Black, so you might see me out there with those again.
Oh, man, you know I love your Yeezys, dude. You know that.
I'm trying to wait for this, like, for the sun to come out, you know, so it starts getting a little bit warmer. But
yeah,
I don't know, man. I don't know when it's gonna come out here.
It'll come once you wear the Yeezys, dude.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, hopefully.
I'll keep that in mind, then. I'll keep it in mind.
Well, awesome. Well, watch out for Sean Ugo Ekwueli playing for FC Cincinnati this season. If you haven't seen it already, definitely go out, check out his goal. If you want to follow him on Twitter, and I believe it's the same on Instagram as well, it's Ask About Ugo, U-G-O.
Well, let me address this, because this just happened not too long ago.
Uh-oh.
But, yeah, I have it. I had an Instagram account. I actually got hacked.
Ooh.
Went out to Florida for preseason, so I lost all of my stuff. But and I've been a little bit hurt because, you know, I've had that account for years now.
Yep.
But I'm actually gonna, you know, make a new account. So I'll get the handle out to you guys.
That's right.
Give the boy a follow.
Fair enough. That's right.
We'll build that back up.
We'll populate it again.
Well, again, we want to wish him luck. As he makes it back to MLS and has his chance to make it big there, playing, I guess he's going to have to steal some minutes away from David Villa and the like, but great to see Sean Ugo Ekwueli become a star here in Cincinnati, and hopefully that star continues to shine as he heads up to NYCFC. During the summer, it wasn't just about USL. Obviously, FC Cincinnati was important to us here with DJ working for them. Obviously, all the other leagues, the NASL, MLS, PDL, NPSL, where I work, all had their things going on. But the summer is also the time for international competition. And this was a pretty special summer, as we didn't just get a normal run-of-the-mill international competition. We got the Copa America Centenario here in the old U.S. of A. And we talked to our buddy Carlos Mojica at the time. He was working for Centro Deportivo. He has actually just recently taken a gig as the communications manager for the Columbus Crew. So congratulations to him. But we had him on back in the summer, one of our summer episodes, to talk about the Copa America. Was it a success? Was it awesome? Was it just a cash grab?
You were there, Carlos. How was it, man?
It was amazing. It was, you know, it was pretty cool, not just because the event itself was, you know, massive, but the amount of people that were there. Some people had traveled from Chile, from Argentina. You know, the press room was filled with people from China, Brazil, Italy. It was a very cool experience. I mean, that's the best way I can think to describe it.
So when you talk about the atmosphere, obviously you've got this diversity in the press box, but obviously the diversity in the stands as well. What kind of atmosphere would you kind of pace to what was going on in the crowd? Because we've seen, you know, I know you've been to a few Copa games this year, and you've probably gotten to see the different types of crowds we've had. Was this one that was kind of just there for the show, or was it one that was like really, really into the game itself?
They went to the game itself, and funny story. So the press box was so full that they actually had a lot of us journalists in the VIP section and the Tribune section. So I was actually in a section where I was surrounded by fans. So I really got to take in the atmosphere and hear the sounds and, you know, the chants, so little subtleties that you don't always get from the press box or the fishbowl, as some people like to call it. The people that were there, it was mostly pro-Messi crowd. And I say pro-Messi because they were more there for Messi than for Argentina.
A lot of Barcelona jerseys there?
Yeah, a lot of Barcelona jerseys, a lot of Argentina jerseys. I counted only one jersey, one Argentina jersey with a name that wasn't Messi's, and it was someone wearing a Riquelme jersey.
So. Wow, so not even someone else that's actually on the team anymore.
Yeah, just, you know, an older 10. Before the match, we're doing some interviews. We tried to get some people from Argentina, some people from Chile, and we interviewed this couple, and we asked them where they were from, and, you know, the guy told us that he was from El Salvador, and so was his girlfriend, but they were there to support Argentina. Then we saw another couple that were wearing Mexican sombreros that were sky blue and white and decked out in Argentina jersey. So everyone was into the game.
Very cool. So, yeah, those not traditional Mexican hats. I don't know that you would really ever see a sombrero in Argentina that frequently, at least in those colors.
Not often.
So
they were Mexican, so.
Good point.
So I guess, you know, everyone's trying to kind of figure out from a standpoint of putting this thing in America, was it a success? Was it not a success? I think everyone's trying to figure that out now that it's all over with and the dust has settled. You've been to multiple matches during this tournament. I mean, what's your take on this? Was this a huge success? Is this something that everyone's going to look to duplicate now? Or was this kind of a, you know, hit or miss?
So, you know, when the tournament was first announced, you know, I was very excited because I grew up watching Copa America as a kid. So it's always held a special meaning to me because, in a way, it's our cup. It's a Hispanic cup. So to have it in the U.S., to me, it was very special. It's no secret that the U.S. has a very large Hispanic population, so logically follow that people were excited for this tournament. If you look at the numbers, it's done a lot better than past editions of Copa America, so the numbers support that it was a success. Now, as far as the cultural impact that it's going to have, I don't think it's going to quite have the same impact as the 1994 World Cup had in the U.S., but I think that it's still... It is something that people are going to try to duplicate because every match that I went to, Venezuela-Jamaica match, which wasn't full by any means. It was pretty, there was a lot of empty seats, but the people that were there, you know, they brought music, they brought their culture, they brought their passion, and it was a beautiful thing. You know, this tournament may have begun because there were monetary concerns and wanted to have financial gain, but at the end of the day, it's still celebrating a tournament that's the oldest international tournament in history, and that in and of itself made it important. So
that was Carlos Mojica. Again, he now is the communications manager for the Columbus Crew, at the time working for Central Deportivo, and also what ended up being the 2016 NPSL national champion, AFC Cleveland. He also worked for them as well. Also, on the international front, back in October, the U.S. men's national team played a friendly in Cuba. We had our friend Tana Weingartner from the local NPR affiliate here in Cincinnati. She was on that trip as a member of AO and also kind of covering it, I believe actually for AO. She wrote an article for them and kind of chronicled their time there. So she came on and talked to us about the experience of the U.S. men's national team making a trip to Cuba in what is now a different, obviously, climate between the two countries.
She was in Cuba. She actually was at this match, hanging out with the folks of AO, of which she is a member of. Tana, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
No problem. So you are, like, pretty much just off a flight. Not quite, but it was, like, technically today.
24 hours removed, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. So landed back in Cincinnati around 10:30, got home at around midnight.
Oh, geez. Well,
and 5 hours of sleep before that.
Yeah, well, we're glad that you had just enough energy to talk to us today a little bit about your experience of heading down to not only watch a U.S. game abroad, which not many people have had the opportunity to do, but also to go on quite the historic trip with the U.S. playing Cuba, obviously in Cuba for the first time outside of a mandatory match in, what, like 40 years. So it's a really special moment, but not exactly the typical one for someone who does go abroad to watch the U.S. play. So, Tan, I know that this all started off with a whole lot of uncertainty for you at the beginning.
Yes, yeah, so we were all supposed to fly out of Miami on Thursday, and then the hurricane obviously delayed plans and moved things around, so everybody was on pins and needles wondering if the flight was going to go. And then it got canceled on Wednesday afternoon, but maybe an hour or so after the flight was canceled, an email came out that the charter flight we were all going to take from Miami to Havana had been moved and was going to fly out of Tampa. And everybody re-scrambled. A bunch of folks were already in Miami. They rented cars, drove up to Tampa. Some were able to...
Good Lord, that's not a quick drive.
My understanding was they kind of did it. They had a van and some people carpooled. They picked some folks up along the way, so... and then they moved the AO night before party to the AO Tampa party for those people that were able to get there in time. And then we all just went to the airport on Thursday morning and waited, hopefully, that the flight would not get canceled out of Tampa. And we took off at noon and landed around 1:30 or so, maybe, in Havana, and got on a bus and went straight to the stadium for the game.
So now, obviously, the whole American citizens traveling to Cuba is kind of a new thing. Is there any sort of extra process currently to go to Cuba, or is it just simple as just book a flight and go? I mean, obviously, there's got to be some sort of
checks going on. Yeah, you still have to have a reason to go. You can't just go to tour. There's like 12 maybe approved reasons to go.
Is soccer one of them?
It was a group event supporting something or something like that was our excuse, an organized sporting event type deal.
Yeah, the loopholes are large.
Yeah. And so the tour company that put it together for American Outlaws took care of getting our visas and stuff. We just had to fill out the form that they sent us. And it was all taken care of. So there weren't really any problems at all with that.
So you went straight to the stadium.
Drove, and you just kind of, when you get to their national stadium, you're just driving down, you're in like the middle of a neighborhood, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, hi, here's a stadium, you know, down in this gully.
So take us through that experience of the match. I mean, kind of being there, hanging out with the AO.
Well, first I got to tell you, we pulled up to the stadium, and it must have been right after the team arrived, because they just waved us down this long driveway. And so our bus driver just went where they told him, and we drove all the way down, like around back behind the scoreboard and right onto the dirt track, and stopped right in front of the team benches and got off the bus right there on the field. Was like, holy crap, we're on the field. So we, you know, took a bunch of pictures, took a big group picture of everyone, and then they realized that we weren't supposed to be there. So they said, everybody get back on the bus, and our bus driver backed it all the way back up this landing, winding road. Went in the other entrance, and they said, oh, you can't come in here because Dr. Jill Biden, the vice president's wife, is at the game, so you can't come in here. Go back over there. And it was a big mess. But so we finally got into the stadium, well, into a bar that's, like, connected to the stadium, and they immediately got us beers to keep everybody, you know, kind of happy. And then on into the game.
As they should.
The international symbol of, hey.
So only a couple of people were good, able to change money, actually, at the airport, too. So a big shout-out to, like, the three people that were able to get Cuban pesos and buy everybody beer. And so then we went right down. Our seats were, like, right on, you know, the 50, right behind the center camera. And Cubans all around us, and the Americans there in the middle. And we turned around, and Dr. Biden was about four rows behind us. So everybody kind of went up and got their picture taken with Vice President's wife.
Weird.
Just
things you don't expect. You know, you're not expecting to run into any, like, you know, diplomats while you're in Cuba, most likely.
Right. No, not all. And I guess I should have. When I Googled it today, apparently this was not an unexpected trip. It was something she'd been planning to make, but I had no idea. So when we got there, we're like, what do you mean the vice president's wife is here? Second lady of the United States.
Well, yeah, I know he's been to a lot of matches. He went to a lot of World Cup matches in support. Now, so the stadium, take us through what this whole setup was. Obviously, we saw it, you know, on TV and kind of got an idea of what it looked like and felt like, but you were there. Give us the full picture here.
Yeah, wait. Let's start here, too. You said you were on the pitch, so...
We didn't actually get to walk on the grass. Well, I guess you got to see it. We were, like, right on the edge of it. We probably could have walked on the grass, but I think everybody was sort of feeling like that would be a no-no.
Yeah. Wise choice.
So obviously, Jurgen and others had some choice feelings about quality of the surface.
It was not in great condition. I mean, that ball was bouncing around. Like, what should have been a nice, flat, smooth passing game was anything but. It would just pop up like crazy or take a weird bounce. It was a little patchy looking up close, you know, kind of brown. I guess we came back later and everybody was saying there's no water in the stadium. So we had no idea that that was a thing, but I guess, yeah, they couldn't water it.
Yeah, there was a like talk here of how the U.S. men's national team had to get ready at their hotel, like actually get cleaned up there, kitted up, and then they bust them in, probably drop them off in the exact same spot that you guys were dropped off, is my guess.
Yeah, totally. We pulled down and Michael Bradley was walking around on the field. So he quickly disappeared down the tunnel. Yeah, it was not in great condition, but you do what you gotta do, right?
Right. So the stadium experience overall, I mean...
It was amazing. The Cuban people were really nice. I mean, we were right next to them. The only thing that was separating us from them was some potted plants and a couple of security guys that I'm sure were there because of Dr. Biden also being in the house. But everybody was really friendly. There was Cuban people wearing American flag stuff, waving American flag, mostly Cuban flags, but, you know, a couple of people like that. The lights, I guess, weren't strong enough. That's why the game had to be played at 4. They weren't strong enough for TV. They would be fine for not TV, but they weren't good enough for TV. No alcohol or water in the, well, at least no alcohol in the stadium, in which we were told was related to Dr. Biden being there, but I don't know if that's true or not. If you had to go to the bathroom, apparently you had to pretty much go all the way back out to where that bar was.
To the outhouse. To the outhouse.
Yeah, right. There was no really announcing a whole lot. The biggest thing was there was no time clock. So, which we noticed maybe about 5 minutes into the game. I'm like, no idea how long we've been playing.
Was there a scoreboard at all that was working or just no time?
Well, yeah, but it's just like manually changed. Kind of like, is it in Boston or whatever?
Yeah, Fenway or Wrigley. Yeah,
Fenway, where they change it from behind. So after we scored that first goal, we were all watching for, you know, the little person to pop their head out of the tiny little window and change it. And it was taking a while. So everybody started chanting, change the scoreboard. DJ, that should sound familiar.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I don't know why you would say anything about that, Tana.
You having flashbacks?
I am, from early on in the FC Cincinnati season. A story for another day. So anyway.
But it was good, and we were singing and just having a good time, and... at the end of the match, it was pretty cool. You know, of course, we did the chant for the team. We love you. We love you. Love you. And then somebody said, hey, can we salute the Cuban fans? So we did the Olé, but said Cuba instead of USA. And as soon as they heard us say Cuba when they were expecting USA, everybody, like every cell phone in the stadium, like swung around and cameras, and they started, you know, like singing and clapping. They were really, really happy about that.
Well, obviously a once in a lifetime experience to go down to Cuba. See the U.S. men's national team play, get to wander too close to the pitch, and to, run into Dr. Biden. So also a pretty cool trip all around. The other big story, really, that's kind of been percolating for almost, you know, I obviously goes back before 2016, but has really taken hold this year, especially here in Cincinnati with FC Cincinnati's ambitions of making the jump to MLS, is the whole MLS expansion conversation. And we now know these 10 markets that are allegedly going to be putting in bids. We don't know. Maybe some of them might end up not putting in a bid at the end of the day. But we know who those 10 cities are, and one of those cities is the city of Detroit, which, while they have some big NBA dollars behind a potential bid,
if a new team were to suddenly come into the market, say a larger, well-financed one, say maybe even like an MLS team.
Owned by Dan Gilbert.
Owned by Dan Gilbert.
Hypothetical.
Though,
you know. Mm-hmm. Right.
What kind of impact would that have on a fan base that maybe is more insecure about the situation than they might let on initially?
I got this one. I got it.
You sure?
I got it.
Okay.
So I was interviewed by a lady who writes for one of these big online sites. I forgot the name of it, but she asked the question. I said, "Look, basically, here's what I think would happen just based off talking to people." The supporters are very, 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 very diligent about their fan group. It's like us against the world. They like take the Detroit versus everybody slogan, which really doesn't apply to most of them, and like really encapsulate it and just that's them. That's every. If you're not a fan of this, then we hate you, which is fine. That's totally how most supporting groups should do. But if you're like a fan of if a Detroit team comes MLS and you're a fan of that, you are not a part of us. That's what they're saying is if you want them to come in here and hear, if you want them to come in, you clearly don't have full love for Detroit City, so you got to go. So if you want to straddle the fence, you know, you can straddle the fence, but you're not one of their hardcore supporters. You are an opposer. You're whatever words they will call you, whatever they'll throw in a chant about you, that's what you are. So that's really how they will feel about it. They'll say it doesn't matter. I don't think it might take maybe a bit of a hit in terms of attendance. The people who sit on the PA box side might maybe show up a bit less if they start losing a lot. The people on the supporter side will still be there. Maybe in 80%, 90%, maybe 10% might peel off to go watch MLS Detroit. That's essentially how I feel it's going to shake down. I don't know. I think John might agree to some degree. I'm not exactly sure.
John.
My whole thing on MLS Detroit is MLS Detroit isn't looking for the hardcore. See, what Detroit City has proved to people that might be interested in MLS as far as like bringing a team, you know, Gores, horrible Dan Gilbert, whichever it may be. All it's proven is that there's viability. Now, what people like Dan Gilbert will think is, since that damn Gilbert, they'll think with, you know, if I can add my income stream, my revenue stream into the team that I start, and then I'll be able to reach more people, I'll be able to seat more people, X, Y, Z. To me, I think of someone that would start a team, an MLS team in Detroit, they're looking for people that aren't, you know, like Fletcher said, they might peel some of the diehards off, the quote-unquote diehards, you know, whoever might define whatever that means. But there are a lot of people that just want to watch what they consider will be the top-level talent. And if that happens to be MLS, there'll be people that go to watch MLS. Now, I don't think it'll fill a 15,000-seat stadium for the first, like, 5 years. So someone's gonna have to be willing to take a hit as far as that goes.
I think if they're a decent team, they will.
It really depends. I mean,
the thing is, though, I don't see them being a decent team. Like I see them
not
getting
for a long time.
Yeah, I see them getting a bunch of like former Michigan greats to come play. Who might be maybe one good Michigan? Like they'll bring Justin Meerum. Great. Maybe they'll bring a couple other people if they can. Or they'll try to get Justin Miriam. I don't know if
Corey's going to get maybe Tyler Arnone, maybe try to get Grinwis, something like that. You know, like.
They're going to get bombed out.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it'd have to be, pardon the term, but it'd have to be kind of a long con. You know what I mean? It'd have to be one of those, like, okay, we're going to get hit in the face a couple times. You know, we're going to take these first 5 years to get our feet underneath us, run in the red. But then eventually people will come around to us.
So is there room in the Detroit landscape for an MLS club? I mean, if you were to just kind of pinpoint that.
No, not there is really. No room anywhere downtown to build a stadium. There is, and the one place there is, the Fail Jail. The site could have been sold to anyone but Dan Gilbert. The mayor of the city is not like Dan Gilbert at all, because fun fact, the mayor of the city is also the brother of the owner of the Bucks. Didn't know if you knew that or not.
No,
But he does not like someone coming into his city and throwing money around. Like, I own the city. And people are like, look, here's this guy, whatever. He does not like that. So he's like, okay, this plot costs $50 million. Cool. What's his name? Gilbert's like, I'll pay $50 million. He's like, no, for you, it's $150.
Yeah.
Because it's you. That's why. Anyone else, cool. But it's you. You have to pay this much. And the guy's like, I'm not paying this much. So now the Fail Jail is just sitting there in the middle of downtown looking like nothing. But aside from that area, we have nowhere to build a stadium. Unless they want to start destroying stuff. Like, they don't
think that's really it.
Stadium.
The only place I can think downtown that might work is Joe Louis Arena. And people would...
They're already bringing down Joe Louis Arena, though, just because it can't.
It's an old building.
No one's going to be there now. But once the Red Wings leave, what is the point of having that arena?
And that's like under a bridge. It's wedged in the corner. I mean, really, it is in kind of Gilbertville. Like Dan Gilbert owns a slew of buildings in downtown Detroit area, Jefferson Avenue and Woodward Avenue. So it would be in the neighborhood of where he wants to keep his cameras and his security detail working anyway. But people in Detroit have a very weird perception of Dan Gilbert. Like, yes, he spent a bunch of money. Yes, he's from the area. Yes, he's employed a lot of people. But how he's made his money and how he treats his employees clash with anything that somebody would want to be associated with. So I personally hope you all know that I'm not an MLS fan, but if it were here, I wouldn't be a hater about it, but I would hate it if Gilbert was the owner. Like, just Gilbert being the owner alone would keep me from supporting the team, or even being a fan watching. Just that fact alone, I would have a fundamental issue with it.
Well,
totally piggyback on that. It's just like, if the team were to come, I would, if they were just like, we're going to be here, I'd be like, I can't fight you. I don't have enough money for that. I don't have, enough clout for that. But just don't be terrible. That's the only thing I'd ask for. But if Dan Gilbert's a part of it, I want them to be the worst team ever so that they get it out of here.
Yeah. So, I would love for him to lose a cool $200 million on a whim and then have to go running with his tail between his legs.
Well, again, thanks to our guys, John and Fletcher. Go check that podcast out, The Outer Drive. Good breakdown. You look at these big markets, and it's not always a slam dunk just because they're a larger market that MLS would work and that everything would fall into place. Speaking of falling into place and will it work and MLS expansion, FC Cincinnati rolled out the red carpet for Don Garber back in the end of November. And they had Taylor Twillman in tow to help usher in the town hall with Don Garber and to MC that whole event. We were able to grab him to talk about what he gets from an outsider looking at Cincinnati as a prospective MLS side and how well this first season has gone for FC Cincinnati.
And now you're kind of coming around to FC Cincinnati, and you've seen what we've been capable of doing over the course of the season. And one of the things that we kind of wondered was, why FC Cincinnati? What was it about the club that kind of drew you to us, even though you're not from Cincinnati and you're a St. Louis guy who maybe would feel a little conflicted given
Chesterfield represent.
Yeah, that's right.
I have the utmost respect of any, I would say any town, any city, any area that supports the game organically. It's not fake about it. And that, I mean, initially, I'll be honest, it was John Harkes. John Harkes, former coworker of mine, got his first head coaching chance with FC Cincinnati. So I was going to watch it anyways. Then I start watching him build build the roster, and I was like, wait a minute, these are a bunch of guys. I either called their games, I either called them in college. They were projected to be great, you know, MLS players where their career never panned out, so they were kind of on the outskirts looking in. So I was interested that way, but opening game, to be honest with you, I was just sitting here and saying, well, wait, where are they playing? It was awful weather, 15,000, and I was like, wait a minute, this is Cincinnati? And listen, I remember Cincinnati Kings, Cincinnati Railhawks, right?
Something like that. Riverhawks.
Riverhawks, yeah. Riverhawks, right? So I remember the, for lack of a better term, failed attempts at the game in Cincinnati. This was completely different. This was real. And I think part of that is in 2016, the soccer fan is way more educated, way more informed. And you can't BS the soccer fan in 2016 like you could in 2002 or 2006. So I just looked at it, was amazed by it, was very interested to see how the whole year went. And then I saw the Pittsburgh Riverhounds game. Then I saw the attendance for the Open Cup game. I saw the product John Harkes was putting on the field with the players. It was hard not to, you know, It's hard to find something that I didn't like in year one, to be honest with you.
Well, I'll take that as nothing but personal compliment to me, since I was responsible for every last drop of it.
DJ's employment is one of those things that you can find fault with.
We've certainly been really impressed here. You know, Jeremy and I both come from a background where we worked for the Division IV side here, the Cincinnati Saints. Jeremy still works for them now, the Dayton Dynamo. So we've certainly been impressed and had our socks blown off as well. And it's always great to hear from the outside perspective that we've been changing minds about what this town's capable of.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where I also think it's part of the game growing. So I think it's unfair to compare Cincinnati today to Cincinnati of 10 years ago. I just think the game's different. I think the game is growing at a crazy rate. I think people expected it 10 years ago, and I think they were a little too soon with it. I just think now I just came to visit you guys, and I had more conversations, educated conversations about the sport, and I just think the fans way more educated than it was in 2006 and 2002. 2000. So that's part of the game growing. And I think it's a little unfair for me to bring up the failed attempts earlier, but that is part of my early outlook on Cincinnati. I mean, that's also part of my outlook on Miami for that instance. And I know we're going to get into this in a little bit here, but I'm still very skeptical of Miami just because of what it was and what it is now and the lack of evidence we've had with that. So, you know, while I may be a little unfair to Cincinnati, I've been greatly, greatly changed. And listen, I reached out to Jeff Birding. It was all me.
That's right.
I just had a huge amount of respect and just said to Jeff, I met Jeff and said, listen, if you ever are in need of anything, you know, that's what I'm supposed to do. You know, part of my job is to give my opinion. Some people forget what an analyst is supposed to do is that I'm supposed to sell the sport. No, I'm supposed to give my opinion. Well, my opinion is very impressed of what Cincinnati is and what Cincinnati could be for Major League Soccer.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, speaking of that visit to town, we did get a question in, and this is something that I think a lot of our listeners will have on their mind with you on the show tonight, and that is, you know, how do you feel about the visit that you had here with Don Garber for the town hall? I know that you weren't with him throughout the course of the entirety of the day, but, you know, what were your impressions and your takeaways from that event?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, just to clarify, I was not there on behalf of Major League Soccer. I think a lot of people thought I was going with Don Garber. Nope, I came, you know, on behalf of me, ESPN, and just to see it for myself. Part of that is because I'm asked this question a lot, DJ, is that, you know, what do you think of this bid? What do you think of that bid? Well, unless I go see it, then I'm really just doing it based on consensus and certain elements where I think it could be unfair. So, you know, and that's why I've been very vocal. I'm shocked Sacramento hasn't been granted a bid yet. I'll tell you right now, St. Louis should and will get a team. Cincinnati was extremely impressive to me. One, and listen, this is an outsider looking in, but no NBA, no NHL, and an owner like Carl and his family. Guys, I'm just telling you, it from the outside looking in, right away, I'm like, okay, now you've got my attention. Then you throw on top of it FC Cincinnati, Jeff Birding and what he's done, all of you guys at FC Cincinnati, the fan base, the game day atmosphere, the fact that the stadium is downtown, all those – the team's good, John Hark's and a bunch of MLS names. It just – I was impressed. Now, logistically, I was more impressed with how well connected, so to speak, Jeff Birding and Carl are within Cincinnati. And I think for my experience over the last 5 years of seeing all these franchises and trying to get new stadiums and living in Boston and all the behind-the-scenes work that I'm trying to do and helping the Revolution get a stadium, it's one of those things, guys, where you just sit there and I'm like, holy cow, it just becomes a little sweeter, every little note, every little tidbit you hear regarding Cincinnati.
Well, once again, thanks Taylor Twillman for stopping by and talking to us. Always cool to chat with a member of the media that covers the game on the whole and that knows MLS very well and the American soccer landscape. Always cool to chat with a former member of the U.S. men's national team. Sticking with the theme of MLS expansion and cities vying for MLS, we talked to our buddy last week, Bruce McGuire, up there in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, about Minnesota United, a team that has climbed that mountaintop. They were a city looking to become MLS, and now they are. They will start their first season of MLS in 2017. Obviously, pretty exciting for them. They'll have a new stadium here in a couple years that'll be ready for them. But from NASL having to take over the ownership of the club to trying to find a place to put an MLS stadium, it wasn't a clean ride to the top.
I guess, you know, we look at now and where soccer has come to, from the Kicks all the way now to Minnesota United getting on the cusp of joining MLS, that first MLS season right around the corner. Kind of take us through, as a fan, as someone who covers soccer in the area, just what has been the last 5 years or so for the game of soccer in the Twin Cities?
I think it's run the full gamut. From 2011, our team won the NASL championship with basically no ownership. They were controlled and run by the Sports Center, which is where they've played for most of their 27 years. But that was on a shoestring budget, and it definitely was not something that was the future of the team. And the next year they played in 2012 with no owner, the league paying the bills, basically the other owners paying the bills, and they lost the final in penalty kicks. They should have won it in the last few minutes of the game, and they gave up a really stupid goal that let Tampa tie it, and it went to penalty kicks, and they lost in penalties. And at that point, the team had no ownership and no future, and it looked pretty dire. And somebody with an extraordinary amount of money stepped in at that point and really put the team on the solid ground that it's on these days. So it's definitely been the full gamut of possibilities and emotions and obviously finances in the last 5 years. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the turnaround's been pretty stark. There were a lot of, I don't want to say a lot of times, but there were several times throughout the course of the last 5 years where there was a genuine concern that there wouldn't be a club in Minnesota anymore.
I mean, for me, it happened for about 10 years in a row, from the early 2000s into almost the mid 2010s, 20 teens, whatever they're called. Almost every year the offseason would come and you'd be like, oh my God, is this team going to make it again? And it went from year to year to year, and there was a lot of giant question marks. And there was one year where the season ended without any of the players or coaches or vendors or anybody getting paid, and the owner skipping town didn't even have the guts to file bankruptcy. He just bailed. And that was really desperate times. So to have someone show up at a game one time out of the blue, I mean, there was somebody out there leading the charge trying to find an owner, but to look across the field and see somebody that I recognized as one of the wealthiest people in Minnesota at the game, what was a crazy feeling. And I went out of my way to try and track him down over the next 24 hours and finally got connected to his group and met with one of the people there and told them how important it was to keep this thing alive.
And that, I would presume, was Dr. Bill McGuire.
Exactly. And the irony has always been, I have a brother named Bill McGuire, and our family has joked for decades that, you know, my brother's a secret billionaire and all these stupid things. And so connecting with them, meeting with them, talking with them, you know, I made sure that they knew our family jokes, which Dr. Bill McGuire is not amused by, but his wife finds hysterical. So,
hey, at least
it's pretty good.
You got an in with at least one of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it gets announced that MLS is coming. There was that press conference there with, Landon Donovan, Twillman was there. So odd bunch of people at this press conference. But then it all came down to, you got to have a stadium. I know that unlike, fortunately, the Miami situation, there became a conclusion and a solution to this stadium thing. But it wasn't exactly a super easy road to get the stadium done in the Twin Cities.
It was only a matter of time, though, because there was three really good options. And from the day that they bought the team and renamed it Minnesota United, their intention was to build a stadium. It didn't matter what league they were going to play in or anything. So they were immediately looking for locations. The location that they ultimately settled on is one of the first that they looked at. They had another option that was in a south suburb called Bloomington, which is where the Mall of America is, which is one of those giant destination malls, and with a light rail line on it, and there's a nice piece of property there. And then there was a piece of property that they actually got a lease on in downtown Minneapolis. And that one ended up falling apart because the mayor and a few of the other city officials just wouldn't back the program. Even though the ownership had come out and said, we're going to pay for the whole thing ourselves. The city of Minneapolis, I think, was just at a tipping point of, we're not going to, you know, have this go through our political system again, after they had just done it for the Minnesota Twins Stadium mm-hmm. and the Minnesota Vikings Stadium, which both cost the taxpayers probably $1 billion combined. And here's someone who comes forth and says, I'm going to pay for it all myself. And that's the one they balk at. Right. Very odd. Very yeah. odd.
Yeah, it seemed like it was pretty close to happening there for a while. And then obviously the team settles on the site that you mentioned a minute ago, which is in St. Paul. And that was actually a question that I have. It's curious, here in Cincinnati, and I, you know, full disclosure, I work for the club. But at the same time, you know, the idea that we would need to build a stadium. And here in Cincinnati, we have the Cincinnati side of the river. And then there's Northern Kentucky, which is, for all intents and purposes, Cincinnati. I mean, it's
where the airport is.
Yeah, it's right. And people.
Yeah, I've driven across a couple of bridges.
Yeah, that's
between
right.
Between the two, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And people, for whatever reason, if we were to have to build a stadium on that side of the river, there's kind of like a stigma that comes with that. And I was curious, does that kind of stigma exist in the Minneapolis, St. Paul area? Like, oh, it's St. Paul. Like, it's a shame that they didn't pull it off in Minneapolis. That kind of feeling.
There is and there isn't. The hockey team plays in downtown St. Paul, and they're as big as anything here. Hockey is enormous in the state of Minnesota. So that gives St. Paul some legitimacy. But there is a feeling that at 5 o'clock, you know, St. Paul rolls up the sidewalks and everyone goes home, or Minneapolis is a proper city. But the location that it's at, the area is called Midway. And that's because it's literally halfway between downtown Minneapolis and downtown St. Paul. So it's almost like it's in both cities. It's very close to the border between the two cities. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of stigma, but it's on a major freeway. It's at probably the biggest intersection in all of St. Paul. So it doesn't really have an out-of-the-way vibe to it at all. And if you drew a map, or I mean a circle around the map of the Twin Cities, it's almost dead center in the middle of it all.
Interesting. So obviously you guys are heading to MLS, but you are leaving a league that can't stay out of the headlines and the rumor mill and the Twitter sphere of what on earth is going on with the NASL. You obviously probably fairly connected with people within that league. What is the vibe you're getting now, as we kind of are no longer in the realm of the league is totally dead, and we kind of – I don't know what is going on now with the NASL.
I don't think anybody does, but when they said we'll have a firm decision in 7 to 10 days, and I saw today that was 13 days ago, I think that kind of tells you all you need. I think that the NASL is a very much of a needed league, and I don't mean maybe the NASL itself, but this kind of slightly outsider, we're going to poke some people, we're going to cause a little trouble, we're going to stir up things kind of league. I think that stuff's always important because they keep asking questions that sometimes maybe the rest of us don't want to ask. And so I find it as a necessary, but if they can't run a good business and keep a solid plan and stick to it, then what's the point?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what we were kind of, you know, we had mentioned this in the past, like, you know, we obviously we lament the fact that there are fan bases that may no longer have teams, but at the end of the day, this sport doesn't grow by bad business.
No, and we've seen so much bad business, it's insane. When Minnesota left the old version of the USL, which luckily your team did not walk into.
Yeah.
In the prior 13 years, from 2010 back to 1997, the league went through 75 teams.
Which is,
I mean, that's insane. A joke. Yeah. You know?
Yeah,
that's not a league.
No,
that's some bizarre. I don't even know what it is.
Yeah, and you were seeing teams in odd places that would.
There was
crop
that whole
up,
Caribbean. Like, yeah, there's like three teams down there.
Antigua Barracuda, and you know the Puerto Rico Islanders, several incarnations of those. And you're right. I think it's an interesting take to hear what NASL offers, and as we reach this kind of crux where maybe it folds back into the USL after taking several years away, we've reached like a point where U.S. soccer maybe needs something that's going to do something like that. And I've never necessarily thought about it in that angle before.
I mean, I think that all the things can coexist. It's a matter of people wanting to coexist, and none of the owners who split off from the old USL to form the NASL, none of them are still around. None of them are part of the modern NASL. And I think that's a big problem right there. I think it's what leaves them in a big question mark when they decide how and why they're going to do business. And you can't run anything that way. It just doesn't work we don't even talk the long haul. Even in the short haul, that doesn't work.
Well, that's it from us. I hope you enjoyed 2016, and I hope you are currently enjoying the holiday break of much of it as you were able to. We will be back next week with our first podcast of 2017. Hey, maybe NASL will have figured out who they and what they are by then. Probably not, but whatever. We'll find out, and we'll obviously have a lot more to chat about with all these matches. See you next week. Bye.